Welcome once again as MIT Professor Paul Samuelson discusses the current economic scene. This series is produced by Instructional Dynamics Incorporated. This program was recorded March 14th.
I'd like today to shift the discussion from what's happening to the general business situation. I also don't want to discuss the energy crisis. That's been discussed a great deal. But instead, I'd like to be responsive to an awful lot of questions that have been coming to me, some of them from subscribers to this service, many from readers of my Newsweek column, but even more, because I'm an economist, I've been approached by various groups of investors who, for the first time in a long time, seem to be desperate for a general advice. There's a kind of a loss of nerve that has taken place in the investment community. So I'd like to talk about some problems of personal finance. How should a person, let's say a physician, who's making a good income, but who's getting older and is going sometime to face a period of retirement, how should he manage his private investments? How should the person of more modest means than a physician, let's say somebody who works for a corporation and has some kind of a pension plan down at the office, how should he handle his common stocks? Should he be buying bonds? Should he be putting his money in the savings account? This is a universal problem. You're a very unlucky person if you don't, in some degree, face up to this problem. Now, even if you're unlucky, there is a similar need for prudent personal finance advice, as, for example, whether you should buy on time, if you have any choice at all, or whether if you buy on time through a borrowing from a personal finance company rather than through a bank and so forth. Well, now, these questions are obviously very broad, and I want to make a disclaimer at the very beginning. If you are of any sophistication, you will not expect me as a professor of economics to know the answers to those questions with any kind of finality. And you'll also know that even the opinions which I have, I will be very guarded about in the way I give them out, because there is nothing more dangerous than any person can do than to give indiscriminate advice. Really, to advise properly a person, you must first know a great deal more than I know, or than I dare to say the typical professor of economics knows. But in addition to that, you must know a great deal about the person who has come to you for advice. You have to be, so to speak, his spiritual advisor. You have to know what his attitude towards risk is, not just as he states it to you, but how he will, in fact, behave through time, whether he's a crybaby about investments that go sour or don't do as well as his most optimistic dreams. It isn't even enough to know him in a way that perhaps only his psychoanalyst can know him. You must know his wife, because the biological team of husband and wife is an entirely different investment animal than the husband himself. I've said more than once, and once wrote this in print, that the best investors in my experience are bachelors with hearing aids. Now, that sounds like a flippant joke, and of course it is a joke, but there is a deeper significance to it. First, the bachelor is responsible only to himself, and therefore he does not have to do what anybody else almost has to do. Any trustee certainly has to do it. Any spouse, I think, ought to be doing it, namely, think about how he will be judged by other people, whether there will be recrimination if he puts his money into that great gold mine in the sky or on Earth, and it turns out not to be where it was thought to be. So most investment decisions, I think, are actually made by people who are not making them just for themselves. The other reason why the Bachelor of the Hearing Aid is the good investor, that's an attempt by me to explain, indicate, that you've got to do an awful lot of work to be a good investor. You have to sit there in the silence of the reading room of the New York Public Library or your local university library, and you have to be prepared to dig into Moody's. In the long run, there is very little luck in the pursuit of security analysis, and there are 1,000 ways of losing your money, and I'm sorry to say there are 1,000 ways of losing a little bit more than the average amount that has to be lost, and it's only people with lots of time and with an interest in the matter who can be expected to do that kind of digging. Even being interested can be as dangerous and as bad as not being interested, because suppose you are a person with gambling instincts. Then I think you can do a great deal of harm to yourself by indulging those gambling instincts in the handling of your own private investments. I always advise somebody who has gambling blood to go to the horse races or the dog races, where the odds are very much stacked against him, but to discharge that impulse in the rather limited way of, say, losing no more than $300 on a visit to Las Vegas on a weekend. You're going to lose that money with a very great probability, but it's much better to lose with certainty $300 than to be fooling around buying soybeans or selling soybeans short on the basis of your family's eating money or its ultimate security, retirement money. And it does make a big difference. I once quoted a saying attributed to one of the Warburg institutions. Probably most of these stories are apocryphal. They're always being attributed to the Rothschilds or to J.P. Morgan. Somebody asked the Warburgs how come they had such good batting average as investors, and one of the partners said thoughtfully, "Do you suppose it's because we take money seriously?" Well, if you see a typical, I even dare to say, professor investing his money, or a typical professional person, you wonder whether he really does take money seriously, because he hears down at the tennis club that somebody has a marvelous way of administering medicine under the skin, and he can get in on the ground floor. It may have a 1,000-to-1 price-earnings ratio, or preferably, it has an infinite price-earnings ratio. I'm told one of the biggest mistakes for a growth company is to get positive profits, because then people will try to decide whether the price-earnings multiple is excessive, whereas if you have no profits, the sky is the limit. It's only your future that that counts. Well, that's a very long preamble. Let's now get down to some details. First, I think it's very clear that it depends upon your age, your income class, your wealth, what the nature of good advice to you would have to be. And I'm thinking of somebody who's affluent enough to be listening to a service like this, who has some real investment problems, let's say who has a net worth of $30,000 or $50,000 or $100,000 or $1 million, or alternatively, and it's quite a different a consideration, somebody who's investing money for a portfolio of $10 million or $100 million or $1 billion. There probably aren't too many people who have a billion-dollar pool of assets to watch. I don't think my advice is necessarily going to be bad to somebody who has $25 billion of assets. I think there's only one group in the world who have $25 billion under their control. It's, of course, will be known to anybody of experience, a particular trust department of one of the large New York banks. Then there are still others that have $15 billion. And if you're running a very large constellation of mutual funds or investment management counseling organization, you will, without difficulty, quite possibly be in the $1 billion of asset range. I don't think that the advice that has to be given to you, provided that you have more than, let's say, $10 million, is very sensitive to the size. I know that there is an illusion that large pools of money are handicapped in comparison with small pools of money, but if you think through the actual mechanics of investment, and if you appraise properly performance, then you'll find that most of that is an illusion. Well, let me talk about people with $50,000 or $100,000, because God must have loved them more. He made a heck of a lot more of them than of people with $100 million. I'm quoting Abraham Lincoln. The first question to ask is, how do you preserve the capital you have? How do you preserve it in real terms? What counts to you, which is its purchasing power, in whatever use you're likely to wish to make of it in the future? And I don't think the problem of how to preserve your capital is different in kind from how do you enhance the amount of your capital. What you're trying to do is preserve it in an algebraic sense, and of course if you could, with less risk, actually increase it, then any investment strategy which enabled you to increase it would be the optimal one. I'm already casting some doubt on the distinction between a speculator and an investor. There are rash investors and there are rash speculators, but everybody has the same problem, I think, which is, other things being equal, avoid ending up with less, and other things being equal, try to, with great probability, end up with more. Now, if I had been talking to you 20 years ago and somebody had asked me the following question, what is the role of common stocks, of equities, in such a portfolio? This on the assumption that you don't have to stay liquid for any purpose, so that within 24 hours you have to be able to tap the money. I would probably have given the following answer. If you must go away on a trip around the world, it's going to take you 5 years, say, and you must leave in an envelope for your trustee the instructions on the percentage that he should hold in common stocks as against the percentage that he should hold in other instruments, treasury bills, long-term government bonds, bank accounts, what have you, then probably the best single number that you can give is a high fractional number, moving up to and even including 100%. In other words, I read with approval 20 years ago an article in Barron's which said that the Alumni Foundation Fund of the University of Wisconsin, which came into existence, I think, sometime in the late 20s, because certain inventions were made by professors of at the university there, usually in the agricultural division. And the royalties came in on those. I'm thinking of vitamin D and irradiation, and I think certain Babcock tests for cream separation, etc. That fund was 100% in equities from its beginning. And it went through, if I recall correctly, the great stock market crash of 1929, 100% invested in equities. And it came back from the great valley of 1932, and it went up and down the roller coaster of 1937-38. And in the war years, when 35% of value of stocks went down, it no doubt went down. And yet, over its lifetime, it had an extremely good good return. And similarly, again, we're talking about 20 years ago, if you'd looked at a whole bunch of colleges, you'd have found that the colleges which did best were colleges like Wesleyan. Now, Wesleyan no doubt had a good treasurer, no doubt had some very loyal alumni with some very good ideas, but the major reason why it was doing better for quite a number of years was that instead of being right there with the mob with 50% in equities, which perhaps was a typical college figure 20 years ago, they were 80% in equities. Indeed, if you follow the logic of this, that 100% is better than 80%, and 80% is better than 50%, because stocks are a great buy, then the fellow who actually went out and borrowed money and leveraged through a margin account or otherwise, who had 130% in equities, he was the smartest fellow of all in terms of presumed average return or mean return. But of course, he would be an unusual man, a person, if he slept as well at night when he had borrowed money, because when you go into stocks with your own money, you do have limited liability, and the stock can become worthless, in which case you tear up the certificate and walk away from it. But if you actually are selling short, or as in this case, you are borrowing money and buying the stocks on the borrowed money, then you can find that as the stocks fall to even less than 100% loss on your equities, you are absolutely wiped out, and there's no way of giving a stop-loss order that will make perfectly sure that you won't, in fact, end up with negative net worth owing, and so you're in a position of social disapprobrium. You are in bankruptcy or otherwise. Well, now, why was it that 20 years ago one might have given this kind of advice with and have a reason story to support it, when that is certainly not the case now? The very fact that men of means are reduced to coming to professors of economics for general counsel and advice shows that there is a failure of nerve, and nobody would believe you if you said that the wisest thing today is to have 100% of your money in equities. I think the reason for that was that people 20-odd years ago, maybe I should make all of this 25 years ago, generally who had lots of money were old enough to remember the Great Depression and the great stock market crash of 1929. The result is that they never really trusted common stocks, even when you could buy common stocks at 4-to-1 price earnings multiples, when they were yielding 9%, at the same time that gilt edge bonds were in those days yielding 2.5%, 3.5%, and mortgages were only at 4%. The result was that World War II and what it had irreversibly done to the price level was not really recognized and built into the marketplace. Now, if what I'm saying now is inconsistent with the random dart hypothesis of the stock market, then I must confess that I am not a believer in the random dart theory, because I do believe that there are times when the general level of stocks are high and unfavorable, and other times when, relatively speaking, they are low and favorable. I'm not trying to say that it's easy to discern those times, and it certainly is hard to prove that you're right if you do have such an opinion. And certainly the methods of proof cannot be those of geometrical and logical demonstration beyond shadow of a doubt, and they can't even be of the empirical type which the physicist can enjoy, that he can say that nobody's going to see the speed of light in a vacuum exceed that of a certain constant, or nobody's going to be able empirically to build a perpetual motion machine of either the first kind or the second kind. Well, no proofs like that are possible. But in any case, what happened was that just as we were in that period of 25 years ago, when stocks were a great buy, the message slowly began to spread. And I would almost name 1953 as the time when it began gradually to be realized that stocks were a good buy. And I traced the great decade increase in the price-earnings multiple of the whole array of stocks to that subsequent time period. All this has been documented in some detail by the famous Merrill Foundation study done at the University of Chicago by Professors Laurie and Professors Fisher and a number of other competent analysts. I may say, ironically, and I say this in no sense of criticism whatsoever, that that Merrill study has probably lost a lot of money for a lot of people, or at least it has given rise to lots of dreams of avarice of how well people were going to do, only to find that their actual experience subjected them to a lot of regret. Because let me quote what the Merrill study showed. It showed that if you started in 1925 and you just sort of bought everything on the board, just throw a dart, or more specifically, put a dollar in everything listed on the financial page, and do this every day, sell out each night and go in the daytime. I exaggerate just a little on how often you'd have to turn over your portfolio. Then you would do extremely well. And this includes the period of the crash and the Great Depression. Of course, if you started out in 1929 and then reckoned where you were in 1932, you'd have a miserable performance. But if you started in 25 and did it all the time, then the average up to 1960, 1965, your average rate of return would have been extremely high. I don't remember all exact categories, but let's say something like 9% per annum. When we reckon these rates of return, of course, we're reckoning them in terms of dividends plus capital gains. Whether you take those capital gains or not, that's the only way to properly make commensurable two different kinds of investments. Well, more than that, the best part of this return that we're talking about came in that fabulous period of the 1950s, when people were just gradually beginning to become aware that higher price earnings multiples seemed to be indicated for stocks. And the people who became aware of that early, of course, bought at low price earnings multiples and were in a position to sell out, if they so chose, at high price earnings multiples. Well, a secret cannot be kept indefinitely. And just as the mob went too far in, my opinion, in, say, the 1953 period in discounting stocks, the mob finally caught up. And by the 1960s, let's say the middle of the 1960s, people had begun to read the Merrill Foundation studies. By the way, these Merrill Foundation studies are completely non-profit. They're not for the purpose of making customers for Merrill Lynch or for any other brokerage organization. They were a truly tax-exempt gift with no strings attached. And there's never been the slightest a shadow of suspicion that the computer studies made were anything but completely objective. Well, you finally began to get the belief that you could coin things, easy money, by good stock market selection. And a lot of people, of course, thought they could do better than the random dart. And you had the performance cult developing and the so-called gunslingers. Now the young people were really in the saddle, and they thought that they could spot Kentucky Fried Chicken early or Ling early or other growth situations when they still had low price earnings multiples, and that they would be able to sell out at high price earnings multiples, and that they would be able to recognize early rapid growth, earlier than other people. It became so widespread that every pension fund began to increase the percentage that it had in equities. And the typical pension fund, and I'm sorry to say this still tends to be the case, kids itself that there's 9%, let's say, to be made in a standard way by a stock market pension fund or even by a balanced pension fund. And with a little extra cleverness, for which they're prepared to pay, and you could really afford to pay, they'll make 11%, and therefore it won't cost the company so much. Well, the truth of the matter is, and this is the first thing that one should realize, when one studies the batting averages of all the groups in the market, when one studies all of the methods proposed for investing, one realizes that there are almost no people, and I don't care whether you're in the biggest banks or whether you're in the most successful mutual funds of the last half decade, there's almost no group which systematically can beat the comprehensive averages. In other words, if you were to simply buy all the shares that there are outstanding in the New York Stock Exchange, the American Stock Exchange, and let's say the over-the-counter market, where at least the stocks are of a certain size, you would find that such a portfolio would do as well, or I dare to say better, than 99 out of 100 of the best money management groups in this country. Moreover, you wouldn't use a crude comparison of how where you started in, say, in 1960 and where you ended in 1965, or where you started in 65 and where you ended in March 1974. A clever person, an informed person, would correct for risk. And if the market's going up and a person is very risk-taking, then obviously by borrowing or by buying volatile and risky stocks, he can get a better arithmetic mean of return, but at the expense of a greater standard deviation of dispersion and of risk. And there are lots of methods which have been pioneered in the finance departments of business schools of this country that correct for the differential amount of risk. So I think the first lesson, and in half an hour one can't really do better than to go into the first lesson, is a lesson in humility. We don't know what the proper fraction of a prudent portfolio ought to be in equities, but playing safe, it will be some fractional number in equities and some fractional number in fixed principal assets. We have no reason to believe that by cleverness or by spending money on security analysis, we will be able to do better than the comprehensive averages. This means, and my time is now running out, that we're long in need of a reform in which the ordinary citizen of small means or of large means is able to buy a prorated share of all there is outstanding to buy. Let's say a no-load mutual fund, a no-management fee or low-management fee a mutual fund, a low-commission mutual fund, which simply invests in the Standard & Poor 500 index. Now, I mention that because it's a pretty good approximation to all there is to hold. But, of course, if we really had this, then it could invest in all there is to hold and go beyond the Standard & Poor 500. Moreover, this is something which is available to a person with $20 billion. Now, why is that? Well, suppose that you have your $20 billion in IBM and Xerox and Avon and Polaroid and the so-called one-tier stocks, and you should, God forbid, change your mind and decide the prospects weren't so good for one of those. Obviously, you cannot sell out without depressing the price. Whereas if you own a little bit of everything there is to own, even with $20 billion, you will be in a very liquid position. I want to bring this discussion to a close. Obviously, the problem is not for people who have $20 billion, but I think there is a clear moral. That fraction of your wealth, which ought prudently to be in equities, ought to be in a diversified list of equities acquired by you with low load or zero load, and so widely diversified that no expensive management fee is payable. A good test of performance would be a very low turnover ratio, because all the money that's paid out to brokers, according to the facts of experience, if you believe in the safety in the total market, is a deadweight loss. Moreover, it's a deadweight loss where it hurts the most. Namely, it comes out of the capital gains part of the portfolio, the lightly taxed part of the portfolio. Well, I think there's a very important lesson to be learned there. I want to go on to say that I've given this sort of advice for handsome fees to some very important investors, but I always tell them, this is advice you will not take, and I've very rarely been proved wrong.
If you have any comments or questions for Professor Samuelson, address them to Instructional Dynamics Incorporated, 166 East Superior Street, Chicago, Illinois, 60611.